I'm very pleased to be here tonight. I wasn't always sure after I set out from Washington this morning that I would get here. The plane started landing out here at your airport, and all of a sudden we were airborne again because the pilot didn't see the runway. Needless to say, everybody was terrified. And when we were about halfway to, was it Peoria? He said, we're going to try to land at Peoria, and if we... You can't hear back there?
No, we can't.
Mic's not working. Testing. That's not working. The system is out.
Microphone.
Testing. As I was saying, when we were halfway to Peoria, he said, if we can't land in Peoria, we'll go on to Iowa, Des Moines or someplace. So I could just imagine spending the night in some hotel not knowing anyone in Des Moines, not even having any good books to read. So when we finally got to Peoria, he started making this very hurried approach to a runway that no one saw, and he didn't see until he got down on the ground. And the plane was like lopsided, and all of us, I guess, were certain, or at least I felt sure, that this might have been the end, way out here in the Midwest someplace. So, anyway, that was a rather frightening experience. But I did make it finally by bus from Peoria to Champaign. And I'm going to talk tonight about the black family. And specifically, I'm going to talk mainly about the role of women within the family, but it will not be exclusively about black women. I'm going to touch upon some of the historical factors of the development of the black family in the U.S. To a smaller extent in pre-colonial Africa prior to slavery. But most of my talk will be about the current status of the family and women's roles within it. Now, since, I guess, 1965, we've heard a lot of discussion about the black family or the Negro family. In 1965, Daniel Patrick Moynihan introduced his infamous report called The Negro Family, The Case for National Action, in which he stated that the family was deteriorating. And based upon his conclusions that the black family was indeed constituted a matriarchal society, that there was a great need to revamp the family and do all kinds of programs with it that would bring it in to some kind of more highly structured form. Traditionally, social scientists and particularly sociologists have not dealt with the family adequately. And my own feeling is that most of the accounts of what actually happens within black families, particularly the functioning of the family and even the structure of it, have a racist bias, have a very white middle class orientation. And very few of the social scientists who've written about the family have actually gone out there to ask black people how their families indeed function. And tonight I'm going to try to talk somewhat about some of the problems that have been involved, and to the extent possible, to bring some, not a new perspective, but a different kind of perspective to the study of the black family. Now, all the classic studies which have been devoted to the black family, to black life and culture in general, have dealt with the attitudes and the behavior of blacks. And none of these studies have dealt with the structural effects of racial oppression and class oppression, or with the specific ways that the society, or with specific ways to change the society so that it no longer produces its very devastating effects upon the family. And because of this faulty understanding of the nature of the real problem, or the inability of social scientists to deal with racial oppression, racial and class oppression, as the main problem in the society, hence the way black people have acted and the way they felt about the world became the object of a lot of stigma because they did not conform to an American middle class status quo or what a lot of us refer to as the white Protestant ethic. The strong resilience and the highly strong adaptive techniques which black people developed in slavery and in modern society to combat racism and poverty were never recognized as important areas for sociologists to study or any other social scientist. Indeed, many experts on the black family so emphasized the so-called pathology of the family that the positive features of the family were virtually unknown. And with this also came an abundance of myths and stereotypes, and notably one of these most prominent myths is that of the so-called matriarchy and of the great lie that blacks indeed do not have or have never really had a strong attachment or value on family life. And to quote from the late Dr. Martin Luther King on the family, he said that for no other group in American life is the matter of the family life more important than to the Negro, for our very survival is bound up in it. And no one in all history had to fight against so much physical and psychological horrors to have a family life. Now, most of the studies and other accounts of black women, particularly, have been very ahistorical. Few of these have dealt with the social history out of which we as a people have evolved. Moreover, even fewer of these studies have been willing to understand and relate to the impact that pre-colonial African society and slavery have had upon the black woman today. And this is because a lot of these studies would rather set forth the idea that blacks were stripped of all of their African ancestral heritage during slavery. A few scholars, of course, have disagreed with this assertion and are now attempting to relate to and to describe and analyze what we refer to as Africanisms. Now, women in pre-colonial African societies played very important roles in their families and the economic and political institutions of their societies. In fact, several of the creation myths in some of the West African tribes today are still based upon a woman. And one of these, as one African historian has noted, is a recurring theme in many African legends and mythology of a woman who is the founder of the tribe, or the mother of the tribe, and she's either a queen or the daughter of a king, and she's an aristocratic lady who is involved in politics. Now, women play very important economic roles in pre-colonial Africa in that they were, and in many countries, particularly Ghana and Nigeria, still are the chief traders in the villages. Now, the West African trader woman is still an institution unto herself. Now, queen mothers and queen sisters were also part of the hierarchy in traditional African society. And the relationship between mother and child in pre-colonial African society was also another very important area of inquiry. The mother was expected to impart the socialization to her children. And as the Ashanti often point out, even today, that a person's status, his rank, and his fundamental rights stem from his mother, and that is why she is felt to be the most important person in his life. Now, this is not to underestimate the fact that women in Africa did play very traditionally segregated roles within the family. All tribes were not so democratic, and I do not wish to make the point here that all African women who came to America emerged from totally democratic societies, because this would not be the case either. My only point is that in many of those tribes, women were able to function as very viable human beings that they wanted to. Now, the African women who were brought as slaves to America, many of them had come from highly organized societies. They shared a strong sense of group identity, and above all else, they had played very important, recognized roles in their societies. Now, slavery in America was a contradiction in terms. It was an alien and degrading form of life from all that she had experienced. Now, slave masters, as we well know, sought to inculcate fear within the slave and a belief in the slave's own alleged inferiority. Of course, we know that they were not allowed to practice their own religions, to speak their languages, and above all else, to function as mothers and fathers, as husbands and wives, in the manners in which they had previously known. Hence, the relationship between mother and child and the function of breadwinner for the family remained fundamentally unchanged in America during slavery because a lot of the economic conditions to which they were subjugated dictated that she assume the kind of breadwinner function within the family. And as families were split up, women became heads of their households and more often than the father, were forced to keep the children. And it was often the mother, as I said earlier, who provided for the entire family economically. Now, contrary to a lot of the popular myth, and especially when we read historians' accounts of what occurred during slavery, parents, both parents, the male and the female, imparted a certain value and cultural ethos to their children. If we read Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist, in his autobiography, for example, he states that if my dear, poor, old grandmother now lives, she lives to remember and mourn the loss of children and the loss of grandchildren. Sojourner Truth recounted the trauma that her own mother suffered when she was separated from her children. Sojourner said that, "I can remember when I was a little young girl, how my old mammy would sit out of doors in the evening and look up at the stars and groan. And I would say, 'Mammy, what makes you groan so?' And she would say, 'I am groaning to think of my poor children. They do not know where I be, and I do not know where they be. I look up at the stars, and they look up at the stars.'" Many mothers, of course, chose the alternative of fratricide by killing their children rather than allowing them to be enslaved as they were. And all of this runs contrary to one of the popular myths that slaves, in effect, had no regard for family, that fathers had no regard for children, that they were, in effect, reduced to the most animalistic level and were not able to impart anything to the child. Now, it's also important to note that when black men during slavery sought to defend their women against the cruelties of slavery, they were beaten and oftentimes killed. Slave masters, through their demands for absolute obedience, reinforced by harsh slave laws, attempted to crush every symbol of humanity within the slave. He not only took away his basic culture, but he also attempted to crush his very humanity. But still, slaves fought these efforts very vigorously, and they resisted them to the very end. Now, we know all too well of the various rebellions, Nat Turner's rebellion, for example. We know of David Walker's appeal when he stated that any man who refuses to stand up for his mother and his wife and for all the women in his family would be better off dead. Now, black women today and the black family today have been influenced by all of these historical traditions. And it is a grave error for us to view the black family at one point in time, and that is to look at it as a phenomenon or an institution existing in 1972 in America without examining some of these previous conditions which have had their great effect upon the family as a unit. Now, the matriarchy has become a very popular symbol that's often used to describe black womanhood. Now, although this label, I feel very strongly, is very invalidly applied. Today, black women play very important, strong roles in their families. Sometimes they play even autonomous roles, because the same kinds of economic, social, and political conditions which allowed for the emergence of a female-headed household during slavery still exist today, except in a slightly different form or to a slightly different degree. Unfortunately, the female-headed household is still assumed in popular terms to be the dominant family form among blacks, in spite of the fact that the majority of black families are indeed headed by a black man. I think it's very important that we understand this, because too often we are led to believe, you know, even in the newsprint, not just newsprint, in authoritative sources, that the black family is a matriarchal society that is dominated by women, that the overwhelming majority of the families, particularly in the northern urban areas, are indeed headed by females. Now, this simply is not true. It is statistically incorrect. Now, given the highly unsuitable conditions in which the black family has been subjected, one would expect, however, that the number of female-headed households would be considerably higher, and especially if we look at the gloomy economic picture for the black male in this country. And on this point, Eric Erickson asked the question, why do we hear so much about the absent father and so little about the present father in the black home, although the majority of fathers are indeed present in their homes? And why do we hear so little about the presence of the mother and what she has achieved against staggering odds? And if it were not for the magnificent strength of low-income What happened? And if it were not for the strength of low-income mothers, surely the family would have disintegrated by now. And why is so little said about the strengths of low-income families and so little about their weaknesses? Now, it's been argued that the so-called matriarchy is a myth because the black family and the black woman have never functioned in the manner in which the classic definition of the matriarchy is posed. Now, the matriarchy has been defined by one sociologist as a society in which some, if not all, of the legal powers relating to the ordering and the governing of the family power over property, over inheritance, over marriage, over the house, are lodged in women rather than men. And if we apply these standards to the black family, or to any family group throughout the world, we would probably say that there exists no matriarchy any place. That's very important to me to understand perhaps the motives behind the application of this definition or this concept of really stigmatizing label to the black family when we know all too well what a matriarchy, in fact, is supposed to be. Now, the matriarchy label has been quite injurious to both black men and women, to the entire black family. It's caused a lot of frustration within black men because it implies, if they believe in its definition, that they are incapable of fulfilling all those responsibilities that they're supposed to for their families. In effect, it means that they have been told that they're supposed to perform in a certain way by American society, according to the definition of what a man's role within the family is supposed to be, and yet not allowed the opportunity by the society to function in that manner. Simply put, he's supposed to be able to economically provide for it, and he has no job to do so. It's also caused certain added responsibilities to be placed on the shoulders of the black woman because of the broader society's expectations of her in conformance with this stereotype. And by this, I simply mean that she has become viewed as a superhuman, as a kind of superwoman, that she's able to carry all kinds of burdens on her shoulders. And in fact, she's only human and not superhuman. In recent years, the black woman has become almost a romantic and legendary figure in America because of these different definitions and stereotypes that have been applied to her. Now, the idea that she is almost superhuman and that she's capable of assuming all kinds of responsibilities for herself and her family through all kinds of harsh economic and social and political conditions has been projected in much of the popular literature and in much of the academic research that's been done on the black family. Implicit in the popular notion of black womanhood is that she's felt to be stronger than other women, and certainly stronger than the black man. Now, it's very ironic to me that as the black woman has been romanticized for her so-called superior strength, she has at the same time been criticized because she's been labeled as a perpetuator of bastardization or illegitimate children. And at the same time, we must also take note of the fact that as she has been romanticized for her role, black men have been systematically excluded from any kind of meaningful participation in the society. Now, this is a kind of dualism which characterizes the roles of black women. On the one hand, they are considered to be the kind of towering pillar of strength that many women's liberation advocates say that the black woman has always been free, and we would like to have some of the kind of freedom that she has had thrust upon her. But at the same time, she's considered an immoral person who cannot ever approximate the model of white womanhood or white femininity in the society. And I'll say a bit more about that later. And I think that this dual characteristic of black women in this country represent a certain kinds of schizophrenia in American society. That on the one hand, we have a great appreciation for strength in anyone, regardless of their color or sex, but at the same time, we condemn it, even when it becomes very functional. But this dual perspective, a dual definition of the black woman's role, has been responsible for many of the kinds of conflicts and problems that women have had to endure. On the one hand, well, she's been forced to accept the images of what American society says that a woman should be. But at the same time, she has had to accept the fact that in spite of how much she strives to become this ideal, she can never reach the pedestal upon which white women have been placed. And until recently, until very recently, this was the source of a lot of anxiety and a lot of frustration in black women. But the new thrust toward black consciousness and black identity have allowed for the development of a different set of standards, an internal set of standards, by which black women have begun to judge themselves, by which the black family has begun to judge itself, and black people in general have defined themselves to be. Now, another one of the themes projected regarding the so-called matriarchy, and is very prominent when we take a discussion of, or take a close look at the black family, is the common notion that black men have been psychologically castrated by women because of the very strong role that women play in the family. Moreover, it is often assumed that the black man's ability to function as the society says men should function in their families is more a function of his having been emasculated, and I put that in quotes, emasculated by his wife or his woman than by the society. Now, although the scars of emasculation, or I don't really like to use that term, or I'll say a deep kind of hurt or pain that black men experience, have penetrated very deeply, but because of the injustices that have been inflicted upon him. But I would doubt very seriously whether these scars go as deeply as we're led to believe when we read psychological, psychiatric, sociological journals, when we read all the accounts of how emasculated, in quotes, he has become. Now, some writers on the subject would have us believe that the damage that's been done to the black man psychologically is irreparable, that he cannot, in fact, be cured. Few people seem willing to accept the theory that much of the damage, or perhaps most of the damage that's done to the man to make him unable to function as he sees fit, as the society sees fit. People seem willing to accept the fact that this is done outside the home and that it is only within his home, only between him and his wife and his family and his, well, I'll say his kids, that he is reminded of his inability to function. And one writer has suggested that this so-called conflict between black men and black women, or between black men and their families, has been advanced very deliberately. And he says that it has been functional for the white ruling class, through its ideological apparatus, to create internal antagonisms in the black community between black men and women, to divide them and ward off effective attacks on the external system or white racism. And he says that it is a mere manifestation of the divide and conquer strategy used by most ruling classes through the annals of man to continue the exploitation of an oppressed group. Now, I think this position seems very relevant for many young black men who blame their failures on the women instead of upon the society. And hence the black male castration thesis has been advanced strongest by a lot of social and behavioral scientists who really do not have a very reasonable understanding of the very intricate nature of a black male-female relationship. And by those who, by popularizing this notion, could continue to systematically exclude black men from equal participation in American society. And many black men have never, I'll say most black men have probably never experienced the type of psychological castration that's described in these different journals. And one author has noted that if one listens to low-income females and observes their behavior at close range, it becomes apparent that somehow the news of their victory over the man hasn't come through to them either. And if women are supposed to be the dominant sex among low-income Negroes, the women do not know it. And on that score, one of them remarked that I've heard a lot of women wish they were men, but I've never heard no man wish he was a woman. Now, one of the very important impacts upon the family and upon the development and functioning of the family has been institutional racism. has had a strong impact upon all facets of the development and functioning of the black family life, historically and present day. The dynamics of institutional racism have been responsible for both the strengths and the weaknesses of the family. And the weaknesses are obvious, but it is the strengths which we know far less about. And it was the impact of institutional racism which has caused the so-called matriarchal society to emerge, which has caused an overindulgence by social scientists in the concept of family disorganization, of family pathology, of juvenile delinquency, violence and homicide, and, in quotes, illegitimacy. Now, one of the most popular arguments or solutions that some people have advanced to solving the problems of black people in this country has been that of assimilation or integration into the mainstream of American life. And usually these proponents use the model of the white middle class family as the most desired for all people, or the model of the white suburban station wagon set, I guess. Now, one must question whether or not the middle class white lifestyle is worthy of the black family emulating. And I would question whether or not it should be used as a model, because I think the very foundation of the white middle class family has already proven itself to be decadent and unworthy of emulation, even for its own adherents. There are too many problems wrong with it, and we should seek another model or create a model. Now, the obvious symbols of this bankruptcy are to be observed in various ways, in the generation gap. And I want to say one thing here before I go further in describing all of these different pathologies that we find in the white family. Black families have them too. Middle-class black families, particularly as blacks become more middle-class, they take on a lot of the same kinds of neuroses or characteristics. I shouldn't call them neuroses. Even though, yeah. But characteristics. And I think that although what I'm describing here is probably much more common to a larger group of people, a larger group of white people in this society than blacks, it is important to note that as a lot of blacks have chosen the alternative model of the white middle-class family as one they should aspire to become like, they have at the same time taken on a lot of the same kinds of things that a lot of young whites are now saying we must get rid of, we must rid ourselves of, because they've crippled us too much. As I was saying earlier, that the obvious symbols of the bankruptcy in the white middle-class family are to be observed in the generation gap and the problems of drug abuse among white youth and black youth today. The tuning out by thousands of young whites into hippie communes instead of actively engaging in the struggle to initiate social change, or simply the withdrawal from society, period. Suburban swingers clubs or sex clubs, when all else is gone from the normal sexual relationship between man and woman, or husband, wife, or your man and whoever you're relating to. Then you turn to someone else's partner, your friend's spouse or whatever. And there's obviously something very wrong with a society that produces that to me. Pardon? It's also noticeable in the absent father in the white middle class home who spends so much time away from his home that it, according to the classic definition, comes very close to being a matriarchal society. You know, the fathers who are constantly flying from one city to the other on their business trips, who spend only Saturday afternoon with their sons in the family, probably never with the daughters, and if they spend that time at all, who get home so late in the evening that the children don't see them, or they stay up long enough for daddy to be there to put them to bed. The women make a lot of the major decisions about how the family is to be run. They are the ones who shuttle the kids to the Cub Scout meetings, the Brownie meetings, or whatever else. They are the ones who go to the PTA meetings. The father is, in effect, absent from the home. And we really should take a very careful look at that. in terms of the concept of matriarchy. It's also evident in the inability of many whites to accept the very basic humanist value that is attached to having children inside wedlock or outside wedlock. And fortunately, many white women are now coming to accept the fact that there's nothing wrong, morally wrong, with keeping your child if you had the child outside wedlock, and that fewer and fewer white babies are being put up for adoption. It's involved with the destruction of the natural resources and the creation of ignorance, poverty, and disease is manifested by the most callous disregard for the preservation of life in all of its extended forms. Now, if this is felt to be the kind of family model that we should be judged by, that we should emulate, then my own feeling is that we should seek other alternatives and more viable standards, because these, which have been set up as exemplary ones, are in the process of internal destruction, and there is little within them which seem worthy of being salvaged. And the fact that white society could produce and perpetuate institutional racism for over three centuries raises a serious question, raises a very serious concern in my mind for its own validity, even for its adherents. And James Baldwin, the black writer, prophetically analyzed the problem when he said that if we who can scarcely be considered a white nation persist in thinking ourselves as one, that we condemn ourselves with the truly white nations to sterility and decay. Whereas if we could accept ourselves as we are, we might bring new life to the Western achievements and transform them. Hence the question, do I really want to be integrated into a burning house? And there is certainly little enough in the white man's public or private life that one should desire to imitate. Now, the question should be raised as to whether or not the dominant middle class should continue to adhere to a system of values itself, which is in the rapid process of deterioration. And perhaps they, too, should seek to devise a different family form, a different family structure, which can save the entire society from ruination. Although I've said a lot against white society, I do not intend to romanticize where we are as black people, because there are a lot of problems wrong with the black family. There are a lot of problems wrong with black institutions, period. Now, in spite of our attempts to define and to relate to black culture, we must be aware all the time that we've been influenced by the larger society, by white society. At the turn of the century, W.E.B. Du Bois described the black psyche as a double consciousness. And he said that the Negro is a sort of seventh son that's born with a veil and gifted with second sight in this American world, in a world which yields him no true self-consciousness, but only lets him see himself through a revelation of the other world. And he says that it is a peculiar sensation, this double consciousness, and the sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a world that looks on in amused contempt and pity. One ever feels this two-ness of being an American and a Negro, two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals, and one dark body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. The nature of this double consciousness has had a major imprint upon black women and the black family throughout our history. And in recent years, particularly as it relates to black women, it has reached a new peak because of the current revolution in American society with women's rights. And many black women who have traditionally accepted white models of femininity are now rejecting them for the same general reasons that I have proposed we should reject the white middle-class lifestyle as a model for black families. Now, black women are the only ethnic or racial group which has had the opportunity in this society to be women, although it was thrust upon them. By this, I simply mean that much of the current focus on being liberated from the constraints and the protectiveness of the society, which is proposed by Women's Lib, has never applied to black women. And in that sense, we have always been free to a great extent and able to develop as individuals even under the most harsh circumstances. Although I must add a word of caution here, that the conditions under which we've been thrust have not been tolerable or have not been very positive ones. But still, there was that certain kind of responsibility that we were able to assume or forced to assume. And this freedom that I speak of, as well as the tremendous hardships from which black women suffered, allowed for the development of a female personality that is rarely described in the scholarly journals for its obstinate strength and ability to survive. We never look at the survival mechanisms that black mothers transmit to their children, for example. And neither is the peculiar humanistic character and the quiet courage that black women have traditionally possessed viewed as the epitome of what American femininity should become. American white women were never allowed the opportunity to develop and become the socially mature beings that many of them must have viewed as desirable. The highly pristine image which they were forced to develop during slavery has manifested itself in the most subtle forms even today. Now, during slavery, white women were protected from black men at all costs, as we know all too well. They were placed on a pedestal and even protected from their spouses in many cases. According to one author, sexual relations were ideally confined to the marital relationship and the very act of procreation itself. And as part of the white man's creation of the myth of sacred white womanhood, and as the perpetuator of a certain kind of racial supremacy, a whole illusionary world surrounding the chastity of white womanhood came into existence. And this chastity was manifested not only in a sexual sense, but it pervaded all areas of her life, especially in a more social sense, and in her family. One author notes that not only did the Southern white woman push sex out of her life as a shameful thing, never to be mentioned, and not only did she silently give up her husband to illicit backyard love affairs, but she also gave up her children to black mammies to suckle and nurture, because according to the myth of sacred white womanhood, the white woman was above such nasty things as attending to the biological functions and needs of child rearing. And in time, these poor abandoned white ladies lived to witness their sons and daughters turning away from them in times of stress and strain toward the Negro mammies for affection, for solace, and human understanding. Now, the tragedy of this situation is manifested today, hundreds of years later, by the pathological hang-ups which almost inevitably emerge within black male, white female relationships, because the larger society still has not changed its basic concept of the black man, of the white woman, or of the white man and the black woman. It is also reflected in the myths which surround the racist assumptions regarding the so-called animalistic sexual tendencies of the black female. One must note that very often white women make the kinds of sexual overtures and advances toward black men, that historically many black men have been lynched because of this factor. And even today, more severe penalties are given to men who rape white women than to those who rape black females. So we still see a double standard of femininity in this country. Now, black women during slavery, and it has persisted even to this time on a smaller scale, black women became the objects of the most debased sexual passions of white men. They were raped. They were forced to bear children by their masters, deny the right to keep the child if the master wanted to sell him. But most importantly, their very femininity and their humanity were denied them because they were considered to be neither feminine nor human. And all of the suffering, black women, I feel, bore a remarkable and perhaps unprecedented courage, and still maintain a very strong concept of self-identity. They adjusted to all of these conditions, and they fought them vigorously, and emerged probably with fewer scars than would seem normal. Now, all of these devastating conditions actually caused black women to become stronger and to transmit the art of survival to subsequent generations. And this is why I take the position that the most viable model of womanhood in the United States today is the one which black women have historically symbolized. The black woman suffers from the twin burden of being black and female. Her life is shaped by the subjugated statuses which are assigned to a woman in the society and to being black in the society, which carry a double jeopardy. On the surface, this would imply that black women should be at the forefront of the women's liberation movement. Yet the problems which the women's movement is addressing itself are far less relevant to black women. Women's lib is led largely by white middle-class women whose problems are basically different from those of black women, regardless of social class background. The protectiveness which white society has imposed on white women has never been problematic to black women because the society has refused to offer us the same kind of protectiveness. And one of the most blatant symbols of institutional racism that's affected the family has been the refusal of the society to allow black men or husbands and fathers to protect their wives and daughters. And as a result of all these things, black women have always been liberated through forced circumstances. Now, another major difference that characterizes black women or sets them apart from the women in women's lib is that the battle between the sexes, which characterizes the women's movement, is a kind of luxury which black people as a race can ill afford at this time. Black women do not perceive their major enemy to be black men and do not need to be liberated in toto from black men, but they need to be liberated from the same oppressive circumstances in the society, both racially and class forces, which black men, women, and children need to be liberated from. A preoccupation with the equalization of roles between black men and women is almost irrelevant when one considers or places this within the context of the total priorities to the survival of a people as a race. Now, in many ways, the black woman is the carrier of culture because it has been she who has epitomized in America what it meant to be black, to be oppressed, and yet given some small opportunity to negotiate the different demands that the society has placed upon the family. Hence, she can be considered a kind of amalgam of all of the different components of black culture. She can be considered a part of the pains and sorrows in America, as well as a part of the joys and successes. But most of all, it was she who survived in a country where survival was not always considered possible. It was she who survived within the family when the very family system was threatened with total destruction during slavery. And today, black women who are entering womanhood are coming at a time when the demands for commitment to the fight of survival for all of black people, and not just for black females, will be greater than at any other time in our recent history. Because it'll be necessary to make some great distinction between what one's basic aim in life is, whether it is to work for the promotion and strengthening of the family as a unit, and hence strengthening the entire black community, or whether she will be very individualistic and say that my own problems are peculiar because I am female, and therefore I must become liberated as a woman over and against being liberated as a black person. Now, I'm going to speak just a moment to what I consider to be the future of the black family. All around us, we see total chaos. We see it in the white family. We see it in the black family. And it's simply a manifestation of what is happening in the larger society. And one of the things which seriously confronts the black family is how it can withstand all of the pressures, the economic pressures, the political pressures, the social pressures that the entire society is going through. And in fact, whether indeed it can, and whether or not our survival as a family is bound up with the survival of America. It may be a philosophical question. It may be one that's already been practically determined. I don't know. But the future black family, I think that the future orientation of the black family has to become much more political. It also has to assume a much more informal educative function. That is to say that black parents can no longer isolate their children from all of the destruction and pathology that's going on the outside. They can no longer try to protect the child in the same manner in which they have done in previous years, if one was able to do that because he was middle class and able to remove himself from a lot of the social problems that existed around him. But parents must begin to socialize their children, I feel, in a much more political tradition, in that they must understand that there is a great need to develop an alternative set of values for the family structure itself that may, in fact, be a combination of many of the traditional values that the family has been able to maintain, such as one that's oriented toward the extended family, and in the process develop a new set of values, or a combination of values, that will allow it to function in a highly technological society, a highly pressure-oriented society that is stripping all of us of some of our basic humanness. I think that the white family may well look to some of the more positive characteristics within the black family as, and perhaps extract some of these for its own use. One of the things which occurs to me is that a lot of young whites who have gone off into communes to seek a different type of family existence may very well be on one level imitating the traditional extended family that has been very popular in the black community historically. But there are several areas in which the black family has, over a long period of time, displayed particular strength and which may very well be viewed as positive things by social scientists. And we must begin to get away from concepts of illegitimacy, of matriarchy, of all the other stigmatizing labels that have been applied to the family. We must try to understand the family as it really functions by going into the homes, by asking the families what their problems are, instead of going out armed with a set of definitions and concepts, etc., and finding what it is we intend to find regardless of what actually exists. And with the final statement I suppose I want to make is that the black family's survival will depend upon the commitment that all of you have toward its further sustenance, that you have toward its further survival, that it will only survive and that it will only get stronger if we find it necessary to put our energies and efforts into making it so. That's all.
Dr. Ladner will now entertain questions from the audience. And may I ask again that you...